and in the valley under the mountains. After checking in on everyone in the family and sending his hellos, my dad, at 18, mischievously concludes, "Have you seen Margie yet? When you see her, tell her to write, and tell Patricia to write. I don't care if she is engaged. Smile." And he signs it, "Bye now, from your big little brother." At 13, the beautiful turn of phrase and the imagery of my dad sitting in Germany, perhaps on a mountainside somewhere as I imagined it back then, thinking about the bits of world he'd seen, stuck with me. Years later, he would affectionately refer to my mother as Schatzi, the German word for treasure or sweetheart. During my first year as a professor, I traveled to Heidelberg, Germany for a conference called Toward an International History of Lynching. I was giving a paper about Ida B. Wells' anti-lynching work, reflecting on black women's long history of standing up to the United States for the wars it has waged on black people and on black men in particular. Sitting in the window seat as the plane descended into Germany, I marveled at the beautiful idyllic town sitting on top of verdant green mountains and looked curiously off in the distance at other towns tucked in the valleys below. For a brief moment, I got to see the world through my daddy's eyes. I remember all the gifts my daddy ever gave to me. 2 fancy yellow bows with ribbons for my hair, a green purse for my 4th birthday, 2 half-dollar coins that I still have, and a picture of my sister, his other daughter whom I didn't meet until adulthood. This momentary glimpse of his view of the world when he was still young and excited about what was possible felt like an inheritance. Like a part of my story whose provenance I could verify. My dad didn't leave a will, but through this letter I inherited a slice of beauty, a slice of his joy, before being a black boy in a world that hated black boys, hardened his heart, and limited his capacity for kindness. I am always struck by the ways other people's stories about my father tend to highlight his empathy and kindness for others. I wonder about a world in which you can be kind to everyone but the people who belong to you. And in that regard, my father's capacity for empathy for the starving children of Africa reflects this conundrum of American empathy. On the one hand, my father had a deep thoughtfulness that I would not necessarily assume he would have as a black man from semi-rural Louisiana. At the same time, he cared more for these black children abroad than he cared for his own children, whom he never financially or emotionally supported. In the spring of 2014, the Nigerian rebel group Boko Haram kidnapped more than 200 schoolgirls in Chibok and absconded with them to an obscure and impenetrable part of the country, where they would no doubt be coerced into being wives for the male rebels. On social media, "Bring Back Our Girls" trended, and then President Obama offered aid to the Nigerian government. Michelle Obama tweeted a picture of herself holding a sign that said #BringBackOurGirls. While black women in the States organized solidarity actions like Rockagele for our girls, folks on the left began to bellyache about the perils of U.S. military intervention. Many black men argue that intervening would be militarist and imperialist, and that the woke position of any of us committed to radical politics should of course be against U.S. military intervention. Many on the left had hoped that the Obama years would bring less rather than more U.S. military incursions abroad. U.S. imperialism is a uniquely troubling evil, even in these days of a waning empire. And as the argument went among some black men on the left, even 200-plus kidnapped, raped, and forcefully impregnated black teenage girls did not warrant U.S. military intervention. In the months prior to the kidnapping of the Chibok girls, President Obama had launched his My Brother's Keeper initiative, which was aimed at creating mentorship programs and leadership opportunities solely for young boys of color. Enraged that he would leave black girls out of his signature racial justice initiative, I joined other black women in organizing an open letter to the president calling him out on his exclusion of black girls. If our president, a self-proclaimed feminist who lived in the White House with 3 generations of black women, couldn't bring himself to use his pulpit to fight for black women, then all hope felt lost. Are black girls ever worth fighting for? I wonder this sometimes as a feminist who still secretly hopes for a man who will fight for her honor. I wonder this more specifically as a fat feminist who has been in one too many rooms where brothers have gone on the attack, misreading my large body as unduly aggressive, often resorting to using their own bodies as physical intimidation, only to have other men in the room do and say nothing. It has never been fully clear to me whether I was left on my own out of resentment, passivity, or some twisted belief that it would be sexist to stand up for a feminist, especially a physically large one who seems infinitely capable of defending herself. I have learned to defend myself because I've never been able to rely on a man to do it for me. That doesn't mean I've never wanted a man to do it for me. It strikes me that if my daddy had lived, he might have cared deeply about the Chabot girls. The fact of his empathy is no guarantee that he would have figured out how to care for and father his own daughters any better than he did when we were children. One of my all-time favorite quotes, one that has largely been attributed to civil rights preaching luminary Reverend Vernon Johns, is, "If you see a good fight, get in it." Is the fight for the lives, safety, and sense of well-being of Black girls a good fight? I think so. Does it have to be a violent fight? I hope not. But far too many brothers have walked away from the fight for Black women's lives citing lack of interest, lack of urgency, or dogma. The feelings of disinterest and the faulty belief that Black girls aren't engaged in an urgent struggle for their lives infuriates but does not surprise me. Sexism, like every other ism, is a willful refusal to not see what is right in front of you. The dogmatic commitment to not fighting for Black women and girls confounds me. On principle, many in Black communities believe that there is never a compelling reason to stand up in unequivocal defense of Black girls. Though patriarchy is clearly a structural problem, often there is a refusal to confront it, because to do so makes it seem like Black women are picking on Black men. Naming the terrible things Black men have done to Black women gets too frequently read as man-bashing and hatred. But as I have said before, we can neither heal nor fix that which we will not confront. Dogma isn't just dangerous, it's deadly. Our politics and beliefs should serve us. We should not serve them. Now I know that this position is also dangerous. I'm not advocating for a self-serving, navel-gazing politic that bends and shifts for our convenience. I'm advocating for people-centered politics that hold the safety and protection of the least of these, among them Black women and girls, as a value worth fighting for. I'm asking what it will take to have a politics that puts Black women and girls, cis, trans, and everything in between, at the center and keeps them safe. What does that look like? Because I sure as hell know what it doesn't look like. When the Chabot girls were kidnapped, I wanted our Black president to use the force and resources of the U.S. military to go in there and bring our girls back. I wanted this same president to use the bully pulpit granted to him by the American people to proclaim that Black lives matter, and more specifically, the lives of Black women and girls matter. He struggled to do any of this, only coming around to cite the myriad contributions of Black women in a speech given in the fall of 2015. Those leftist radical pontificators who reside in a utopian place I like to call woke land called my position, this desire and advocacy for intervention on the part of Black women, imperialist. Black womanhood is not a politically pure category by any stretch. Any evil act we can think of, we can of course find some Black woman who has committed it. But structurally, it is absolutely untenable to suggest that Black women are imperialists and colonizers. In the context of the United States, our reproductive capacities were conscripted to build the capital base for the assertion of the U.S. empire. After slavery, our bodies and the children they produced were tethered to multiple generations of low-wage work and poverty, providing staffing for the perpetuation of the U.S. underclass. The desire for protection and safety is not an imperial desire. Asking the leaders of your country and the members of your race to fight for you, if you're Black, is not a colonizing act. They are demands for recognition of citizenship and humanity. Black women know intimately what the process of U.S. militarism does to Black men. What military-style policing does to Black communities. We know what it means for the military to become the only viable option that so many of our people have had for access into the middle class. Every opportunity I get, I stridently discourage the young men in my family from treating the military as their pathway out. Far too often in these days of endless war and in wars past, it sends or has sent back to us men with war raging in their hearts and ringing in their ears. Those men who cannot cut through the madness of the violence they've seen and in which they've been forced to engage see Black girls and women as targets, as objects for violent sexual release, as punching bags, as emotional chopping blocks. When I was 5, Bob came back. He had spent a few years in prison for his crimes against my parents. We were leaving grandmother's house when Rebo, my grandmother's first cousin, flagged us down to say that Bob is out and he's been looking for you. A few minutes later, Bob drove past, recognized my mother, and pulled over, waving her to his car. Rebo, who was more like an aunt to my mother and her siblings, looked nervous, and my mama looked shook. She said nothing, but then she didn't have to. 5-year-olds understand brute emotions like fear. I didn't know who Bob was or why it felt so cloudy and dark in the car when the sun was shining so brightly outside. I didn't ask questions, though. By then, my own father had caused enough chaos for me to know what danger looked, smelled, and felt like. Frantically, my mother rushed back to town and drove directly to Cherry's gun shop. Inside Cherry's, a young white woman behind the counter showed my mother a small handgun. "It's .250," she said. My mama just shook her head, piled me into the car, and took me home while she actively figured out Plan B. By the time we made it a couple of miles to our place in the projects, she had arranged for me to go to my next-door neighbor's to stay with my bestie Lawrence and his parents. Before she left, she kneeled in the front yard so that we were eye to eye and told me, "Bob is a bad man. I'm going to the courthouse to see the judge so he can't bother me." I nodded. My mother has always had a policy of radical honesty with me, even when I was too young to understand all the ins and outs. I went inside to play with Lawrence, hoping that the judge could do something to keep the bad man away. What does it mean to build a world in which black women and black girls are safe? Jail clearly didn't keep Bob away from my mother and me, and the restraining order didn't keep him away forever either. Moreover, despite my desire for Barack Obama to send our troops to rescue the Chabot girls, the U.S. military apparatus causes harm both at home and abroad. Black men often parrot this logic of the U.S. nation state, engaging either in the politics of doing harm or the politics of doing nothing. And we, black girls, black women, are not saved. How then shall we live? What do black men, who have in the aggregate been the purveyors of so much harm, owe to black women? Black men took those black girls in Chabot. Black on different terms than we understand black manhood in the United States, but black men nonetheless. That is why it felt so egregious to hear radical progressive black men in the United States talk about all the reasons why those little girls were not worthy of U.S. intervention. A black man shot my mother. 4 different black men shot my father. 1 of those black men killed him. 2 different black men put their hands on my mother. 1 of those men was my father. I'm a black girl. A grown black girl who wants the men in my life and men who are bystanders in critical moments to fight for my honor. I want them to have the protective impulse that my mother's big brother had the night she was almost killed. I want men to have the impulse my Uncle Carl Lee, my daddy's brother, had the afternoon that he chased daddy around the living room to stop him from putting hands on my mother. My Uncle Carl Lee reminds me of the character Carl Lee Haley in the movie A Time to Kill. When 2 white racists in Mississippi kidnapped and raped Carl Lee's beautiful little girl, that black man took his shotgun and took them out. I've seen enough gun violence not to actually desire men to act this way, but I appreciated his moral clarity. They had harmed his daughter and thrown her in a ditch to die as though she were disposable. He had to take them out. I want black men to feel that impulse of protection for black girls everywhere, even when those black girls aren't their daughters, but especially when they are. I'm a black woman who wants to live in a nation that believes it has a responsibility to black women as citizens and as people to make the world safe for them. I'm a black feminist who cannot reconcile my desire for men to fight for my honor with my general abhorrence for violence. I'm a feminist who cannot reconcile my desire for U.S. military intervention in Chabot with my utter hatred of guns. I'm a feminist who cannot reconcile my desire for my nation state to intervene on my behalf with the woke analysis feminism has bequeathed me about the perils of getting in bed at any level with the logics of patriarchy and militarism. For these things might protect you one minute and kill you the next. I am my mother's daughter, and I have been taught always, always, to stand up and fight honorably for myself. I am also the daughter of my father, man, who brought more relief in his absence than with his presence, who taught me that there was more security in his leaving than in his staying, a man whose lack of respect for boundaries made me chronically afraid at levels that were no less nerve-wracking than the acuteness of the fear Bob induced. Now I am a grown woman trying to build a life where I can get in bed every night with a man who knows that my desire for him to hold me down does not in any guise mean that I want him to put his foot on my neck. I'm a grown woman who feels like these obvious things have to be said explicitly. I am too afraid to say these things that need to be said because the consequence of my demands might be another man leaving me, and my father taught me that my needs weren't compelling enough to make a man stay. I am, then, a grown woman who struggles mightily to trust what it might mean for a man to stay, to show up, to catch me when I fall, acquainted as I am with the relief that comes when they finally, simply go. The leaving feels like the tanks are finally pulling out, but also like I am on my own. So when the good brothers come to stay, looking so much like the enemy, when they come in talking sweetly and meaning it, being loving and meaning it, occupying your thoughts and taking up space, it feels just like that, like an occupation. Now that I'm grown, my mother speaks more freely about what these men who shaped her youth meant to her. Of my father, she says, looking off into the distance, he was a terrorist. My father controlled our lives through constant surveillance and random acts of violence designed to reinforce his control, power, and ownership. But my mother felt like she owed my father loyalty because she felt guilty for getting him shot. And perhaps because she had learned how costly disloyalty could be. Of Bob, she says, he was a fatal attraction, to whom she was attracted, in her words, because of low self-esteem. Eventually, my mother met and married a lovely man, my stepfather, to whom she has been married for more than 2 decades. Much like these other men, my stepdad, a preacher whom I affectionately call Rev, told me about his own reckoning with the ways his father had been physically abusive toward his mother. I resolved that I would never put my hands on a woman, Rev told me once. All of these men, my father, my stepfather, and Bob, had to contend with the models handed down to them. But only Rev seemed to come to the right conclusion. My mother, for her part, always felt like her ability to make better romantic choices came from learning to love herself. I'm sure that's part of the story, but it's certainly not all of it. Self-help gurus, pastors, and poets love to point to black women's low self-esteem as the cause for all black girl problems. Just learn to love yourself, we are told. But patriarchy is nothing if not the structurally induced hatred of women. If every woman and girl learned to love herself fiercely, the patriarchy would still be intact. It would demand that she be killed for having the audacity to think she was somebody. Individual blame isn't enough to solve the problem. How are black girls supposed to grow up to be black women in love with themselves in a country built on the structural negation of black women's humanity and personhood? Too much of the conversation about patriarchy in black communities pivots on black women's low self-esteem. Black women are often admonished to make better choices. But my mother left Bob when he didn't treat her right. She almost lost her life for it. The deadliest time for a woman in an abusive relationship is when she decides to leave. Still, despite almost being killed, when things got to be too terrible with my father, she left him too. From where I sit, my mama made the right choice to leave every time it became clear that her man wasn't going to treat her right. The abuse had nothing to do with her choices and everything to do with the ways we don't demand that men stop being violent. Mama says she prayed about when to leave my daddy, asking for the Holy Spirit to show her, a 23-year-old woman, the right time to end things. We should not have to rely on supernatural acts of God to keep women safe. And though my mother is clearly my hero, she deserved better options and more help. Young women encountering violent men today deserve those options too. It's not enough to teach women how not to attract violent men. We have to spend our time teaching young men how not to be violent men and partners. Surely Man and Bob did not hold themselves in high esteem. On the day that my daddy finally, peaceably retreated from our home, he didn't even look me in the eye. He couldn't. His abdication of responsibility was egregious, yes, but the humiliation of learning that you have taken so much that no one in your home wants anything you have to give is surely an unbearable feeling. The violence that men do demoralizes them too. Having a structural analysis of the logics of patriarchy doesn't let Man and Bob off the hook. War narrows the frame of masculine possibility and tethers it irreparably to violence. In every part of their lives, young men need access to conversations about what it means to be a man in ways that are not rooted in power, dominance, and violence. We owe it to ourselves to imagine what a post-patriarchal black masculinity might look like. And frankly, until we have that conversation, men will continue to kill black women, cis and trans, and they will continue to kill each other. Perhaps we could start with empathy, though. This is the thing about my father's story that always strikes me. He was a deeply empathetic man, caring greatly about the injustices in the world around him. Social scientists have spoken of a phenomenon that they call the racial empathy gap, in which people, regardless of race, believe that black people experience less physical pain than white people experience. This racial empathy gap influences everything from harsher sentences for crime to differential prescribing practices for pain medication based on race. It strikes me that among black men and black women, perhaps there is a gender empathy gap. There is certainly a broader gender empathy gap in which women are perceived to experience less pain than men and are treated for pain less aggressively than men. Professors Diane Hoffman and Anita Tarzian have found that women frequently receive inadequate treatment for pain and often that psychological and emotional pain receive less treatment than physical pain. The presence of both a racial empathy gap and a gender empathy gap doesn't bode well for black women, even though they haven't been a direct focus of these pain management studies. Because black women are viewed as preternaturally strong, our pain often goes unnoticed both in the broader world and in our communities. Black men frequently don't acknowledge our vulnerability, don't seem to think we need defending, and don't feel a political responsibility to hold black women, who aren't their mothers or sisters or daughters, up and honor them. There seems to be no empathetic register for understanding the sheer magnitude of the physical and emotional pain the systems of racism, capitalism, and patriarchy inflict on black women every day. Black men grow up believing and moving through the world politically as though they have it the toughest, as though their pain matters most, as though black women cannot possibly be feeling anything similar to the dehumanization and disrespect they have felt. That it might, in many cases, be worse for us seems to many men a preposterous supposition. My father, for instance, showed far more empathy for the man who shot him than he ever showed for the woman whom he claimed to love the most. Patriarchy numbs men's collective pain sensors, and it causes black men to not see black women as worthy of care and concern. To be clear, showing care and concern for the woman you want to sleep with or the women who are related to you is not the same as having an overarching commitment to black women's political, social, and personal well-being as a justice project. Lest I be mistaken, though, black men didn't invent patriarchy. Patriarchy is America's daddy issue. America rules the world through war, the same way patriarchs rule families with an iron fist and a Janus-faced promise of either violence or benevolence, depending on which day you catch them and how well you bow down and do their bidding. Our government does not just wage war abroad. It wages war in black communities at home, controlling black folks through surveillance and violence, demanding their submission and compliance. When submission and compliance is not freely offered, the state murders black men, women, and children, citing the rule of law. The war on drugs is only the most obvious example of a war that the U.S. government declared and waged on black communities. That particular war and the ways it targeted black men and destroyed black families often rendered black women the spoils of war. And we have been treated as such, as trophies for men to tote around as evidence of their power and greatness. White men who waged war paraded narratives of black women before the American public in the 1980s, calling them welfare queens and crack addicts, and using hatred of black women to curry favor with the American public. Black men, demoralized by wars both at home and abroad, took possession of the one thing that was left, the women, treating us as their own kind of trophies, pretty objects that bolster their social capital, while commanding or compelling no responsibility from them for and to us. In his famous 1967 sermon, Beyond Vietnam, Martin Luther King preached about the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism. He preached about the brutal solidarity that brought together white men and black men who didn't even live on the same block back home. King didn't name patriarchy as a founding evil of the U.S. nation state, but that brutal solidarity that men experienced across race as they went to war cannot be understood outside of a Western patriarchal fantasy that seduces so many brothers whose definition of freedom is a desegregated patriarchy. Black men didn't just experience racial equality on the battlefield, they experienced gender equality too. After Truman desegregated the armed forces in time for the Korean conflict, black men got to engage in American carnage as equal citizens, not as black or white, but simply as men. I'm sure that's how a military brochure might put it. But what King didn't live long enough to think about was what it would look like for a whole generation of men, black men in particular, to come back from that war. The Vietnam War was a Pyrrhic victory not only because of its dubious status as a victory abroad, but also because it dropped black men back off in the same racist hoods they left, this time not only with PTSD, but also with the same limited access to patriarchy and the power of white men that they learned to crave. So many black men escaped the racist wars of segregation and criminalization being waged in their own backyards by agreeing to fight America's many racist wars of aggression abroad. That is a perverse model of both masculinity and freedom, and it is black women and girls who have paid the highest price for it. But black men have paid the price too. My daddy was certainly a casualty of war. Of the wars black people wage on each other when there are no proper outlets for the living out of our dreams or the expression of our rage. Those wars are wars of mundane but devastating violence enacted on those who live in closest proximity to us. It is our own country that uses war as a tool to compel violent submission from those people in other places that we claim to care about. But unchecked violence does not just topple empires, it also devastates men. Both Bob and Man lost the girl they loved and left a lifetime of resentment, pain, and anger in their wake because they chose to live out the lie that surveillance, control, occupation, and terror are acceptable ways to treat the people they claim to love, when the truth is that these acts are never acceptable for anyone at all. Bag Lady. On the very day that Sandra Bland was pulled over in Waller County, Texas, just a stone's throw away from the entrance to her alma mater, Prairie View A&M University, I was on an Amtrak train on a day-long round trip to Harvard University. Bland, a 28-year-old Chicago resident, was completing a drive to Texas to begin her dream job at Prairie View. I had been called to come to the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics to speak to young scientists about the importance of employing intersectional perspectives in STEM research. Intersectionality, or the idea that we are all integrally formed and multiply impacted by the different ways that systems of white supremacy, capitalism, and patriarchy affect our lives, was a mostly foreign notion to these young scientists. Intersectional education happens primarily in the kinds of college classrooms that cause conservative politicians to lose their shit on the regular. Intersectionality is considered fluffy, liberal, radical, and certainly not scientific. Intersectionality is not only not objective, it sneers at claims to objectivity, arguing that none of us is purely objective. We all come with a perspective and an agenda. We all have investments. We all have skin in the game. As I stood at the podium doing my thing in that Harvard classroom, no one could tell that my fervent desire was to find somewhere to curl up and weep. I had spent the better part of the 4-hour train ride arguing via text message with a high school sweetheart who had managed to swoop back in with a load of new school promises that I had recently discovered he had no intention of keeping. On the brink of 35 at that point, my career was going exceedingly well, and I thought it the responsible thing to do to begin to turn my attention toward building a family. When I'm not railing at the patriarchy and reconsidering whether a traditional marriage is for me, I spend my time reading romance novels. My favorite romance story plot is always about young lovers who lose touch, reconnect, and then live happily ever after. On this particular summer morning, I was learning for the last time that this would not be my story. I was officially all out of childhood and teenage sweethearts, and there had been a few with whom to try to make this fantasy work. About 1 hour before I arrived, I sent my last curse-filled text to my ex, an equally curse-filled text to my homegirl who had been offering sympathy, outrage, and possible revenge plots throughout the entire scenario, and then tried to calm my spirit and plaster a smile on my face so I could go explain to this group of eager students the intersectional conundrums that shaped my regular black girl life. I couldn't fall apart like I wanted to because, well, I'm a black girl, and we don't get the luxury of doing frivolous shit like that. This was an invitation to speak at Harvard, after all. Business always comes first. Broken hearts, later. Black women's historian Darlene Clark Hine coined a term for the performance I was putting on. She called it the culture of dissemblance, this enigmatic way that black women in the late 19th and early 20th centuries moved through the world, often doing race work of the type I was doing that day, giving the appearance of being open while fully obscuring the operations of their inner lives from public view. While I was busy dissembling, Sandra Bland was in another part of the world, completing what amounts to a return migration back to the South from Chicago, the very city that 2 generations earlier had seen so many black people fleeing north to escape the pervasive quotidian horror of Southern state-sanctioned racial violence. She was just a few hundred yards from completing her journey when she ran into a 21st century specter of a violence that we all hoped was long gone. When she made it to University Drive, the street that runs into the campus of Prairie View, a Waller County police officer began following her. She thought he wanted to pass, so she pulled over. He pulled over behind her and was apparently planning to write her a citation for failure to signal a lane change. She could almost see the university from where she was sitting. She was that close to her dream job. Instead, Officer Brian Encinia decided to harass, assault, and arrest Bland because she refused to be servile during the traffic stop. She did not berate the officer, but she did let him know she wasn't pleased that he had pulled her over on a bullshit charge. Incensed by her lack of deference and her seeming lack of fear, Encinia grabbed his taser, opened the door, reached into the vehicle, and yanked Sandra Bland out of her car while yelling at her, "I will light you up." A local bystander stopped to tape the incident, and Bland, who was a great supporter of the Black Lives Matter movement, thanked the bystander for taping. She narrated that the officer had just slammed her head into the ground and cuffed her wrists so tightly she thought they might break. A Black woman officer can be heard off camera telling a struggling Bland, "Well, you should have thought about that." Bland spent the weekend trying to arrange for someone to bring the $500 needed to bail her out of jail. $500 is such a small amount, but the cost is prohibitively high in a world where Black women between the ages of 18 and 64 have been estimated to have only about $100 of net wealth. Not only do most Black women not have $500 to spare in case of emergencies, but many don't have networks of family or friends with that kind of money to spare either. On Monday morning, July 13th at around 9 a.m., Sandra Bland was found dead. The official narrative is that she hanged herself by placing a trash bag around her neck. I don't know what happened to Bland in that jail cell. It's easier to believe and entirely plausible that rogue police officers murdered her. In March 2016, Brian Encinia was fired and charged with misdemeanor perjury for giving a false account of what happened at the traffic stop. In June 2017, local prosecutors dropped all charges. Encinia surrendered his law enforcement license and agreed that he would never work in law enforcement again. Caring for Black women's actual lives means sitting with the acuteness of our fragility. We break, too. Police at the White House killed Miriam Carey in 2013. She was a mother suffering from severe postpartum depression who, it seems, took a wrong turn at the White House gates with her baby daughter strapped into the back seat. She was killed in a hail of bullets while her baby daughter sat helpless. Tanisha Anderson of Cleveland, Ohio, experienced a mental health crisis which caused her children to contact police for help to assist their mother in taking her medicine. Instead, an officer handcuffed her, and when she began to struggle, he restrained her by putting a knee in her back, effectively smothering her while her children watched. The county medical examiner ruled her death a homicide, and the police department settled with the family for over $2 million. The system's response to seeing us bend is to break us entirely. For Black girls, many of us teeter on that brink. If one more thing goes wrong, we feel like we just can't make it. We go to church like Bland, a church girl herself. There, preachers tell us, "Your blessing is just around the bend. Keep pressing." On March 1st, 2015, Bland uploaded a video to her vlog, Sandy Speaks. She admitted to struggling with depression and PTSD and spoke out against the stigma and shame that many who struggle with depression feel. She apologized for not having vlogged regularly and told her listeners, "I'm just a human." And then she mentioned that though she had missed church that morning, she watched a bit of the service and the morning's message had been about faith. Just 4 months later, that same faith caused Bland to press her way to Texas for her dream job. Through Sandy Speaks, Bland talked about everything from her recent struggles with depression after losing a pregnancy to her outrage over the police killings of unarmed Black people and her support for the Black Lives Matter movement. Unlike the race woman of old, Sandy Bland did not dissemble. She shared her private struggles right alongside her political views. On the morning of July 10, 2015, Sandra Bland and I were two Black women chasing our dreams, even in the aftermath of our heartbreak. I know exactly what it feels like to pack all of my belongings into the car and drive more than 1,000 miles to the gates of a university that holds my career hopes and dreams. I've done it more than once, and I know how much I relied on my faith in God and myself to travel every mile. It's classic for writers to spend time waxing eloquent about the possibilities and perils of life's metaphoric journeys and the roads we either do or don't travel. But the dangers that attend Black people's actual travels are not in any guise metaphoric. Reminiscent of earlier periods of racial terror for African Americans, traffic stops have again become the pretext for the reckless taking of Black life by police. In April 2015, South Carolina police officer Michael Slager killed Walter Scott after stopping him for a broken taillight. Slager was charged with murder and brought to trial. though a local barber who was walking through the area shot clear video of Slager shooting an unarmed Scott as he was running away, a judge declared a mistrial in December 2016 after a local jury failed to return a verdict. In May 2017, Slager pled guilty to federal charges that he violated Scott's civil rights. He is now serving time in federal prison. In August 2016, after Corin Gaines, a 23-year-old mother from Baltimore, failed to pay a traffic citation, members of the police force arrived at her house to serve her a warrant for failure to appear in court. The standoff ended when police kicked in Gaines' door, shot and killed her, and shot her 5-year-old son. And in July 2016, a Minnesota police officer shot and killed Philando Castile after Castile requested permission to pull out his gun and concealed weapons permit for the officer's inspection during a traffic stop for a broken taillight. The officer was acquitted of all charges despite damning dashcam video suggesting that Castile did nothing wrong. Because traffic stops are frequently a life or death matter for Black people, stopping traffic has become one of the primary modes of protest for the Black Lives Matter movement. The shutdown of major interstate highways began in August 2014 after a police officer shot 18-year-old Michael Brown and left his dead body lying in the street for 4.5 hours. In the weeks that followed across the country from St. Louis to Atlanta to Oakland, protesters began to form human barriers across major highways while holding signs and chanting, "Black Lives Matter," and "Hands up, don't shoot." Charlene Carruthers, National Director of the Black Youth Project 100, has said, "When people disrupt highways and streets, it is about disrupting business as usual. It's also about giving a visual that folks are willing to put their bodies on the line to create the kind of world we want to live in." Feminist activist Naomi Wolf once said, "For a protest to be effective, you have to stop traffic." Carruthers understands the stakes of Black people putting their bodies on the line to stop traffic as a kind of visual prophecy of the world we want to see, a world where we all can go to our destination safely and soundly, or no one can. When they put their bodies on the line, they dramatize the danger for all people who are stuck in traffic. Black women have long been aware of what it means to be stuck in traffic, confined to the intersections of social discourses that bypass us on their way to futures to which we don't have access. In the late 1980s, legal scholar Kimberly Crenshaw named this seemingly shared quality of Black women's lives intersectionality. Intersectionality makes clear the ways that systems of power interact in Black women's lives to restrict social mobility and to hinder us from moving unencumbered through the social sphere. Pulled over at a traffic stop, peering intently down University Drive to the destiny she had created for herself, Sandra Bland was yanked into a future that precisely mirrored the violent Black past that we are presently and collectively obsessed with escaping. She was right there, at the intersection of destiny, dreams, and death. Death won, assisted in its victory by those with real power. 5 months before she was killed by police, Corin Gaines was pulled over in Baltimore County for a traffic stop. She had replaced the front license plate on her car with a cardboard sign that read, "Free Traveler." The back plates had a similar cardboard sign that read, "Any government official who compromises this pursuit to happiness and right to travel will be held criminally responsible and fined, as this is a natural right and freedom." I know to regular law-abiding folks, Corin sounds crazy. Hers is the kind of brazenness the world tries to beat out of Black girls before they reach adulthood. For many who are apologists for state violence, her declaration of her freedom and her rights sound like an invitation to harassment. But let's do this young Black woman, one who had undoubtedly heard of Sandra Bland's story, the courtesy of suspending our disbelief. She chose to be eccentric, defiant, outrageous, and dare I say visionary, in a world where Black women and girls don't often get to do any of these things without lethal consequences. There's a thin line between clarity and craziness, and sometimes clarity can be crazy-making. For there is a profound argument in the particular terms through which Corin Gaines chose to elaborate her freedom project. She argued, by way of a makeshift license plate, that the pursuit of happiness and the right to travel are natural rights, rights that are endemic to any declaration of freedom. The struggle by Black people to obtain the free and full exercise of their natural rights and continual forms of structural opposition to these rights have been a fundamental feature of what it means to be Black in America. To get bogged down or distracted by the policy and procedure elements of her approach is to miss the soundness of her conclusions. By declaring her rights to travel, to freedom, and to happiness to be natural rights, Corin Gaines invoked a very particular discourse about the origin of our natural rights. If freedom to travel and freedom to be happy are civil rights or legal rights, they exist entirely at the whim and fancy of the U.S. government. If, however, these matters are natural rights, they are not bound by the exigencies of policy and procedure. The problem is not that Corrin Gaines believed these ideas about herself, but rather that she chose to make them explicit. How can this black woman's notions of freedom, her audacity in trying to live free, seem so preposterous and exasperating and so utterly reasonable and exhilarating at the same time? More than any of us, she seemed to have a clear vision of what freedom for black women looked like. The ability to get in a vehicle of your choosing, strap your baby safely into the back seat, and make your way to the place where you were trying to go. This conception of freedom, the ability to travel unencumbered to the places where you need to go, is something black women have been fighting for since they first encountered America. I think of 21-year-old Ida B. Wells, who in 1883 was violently removed from the ladies' car of a train in Memphis, Tennessee, because colored women were not allowed to sit there. Because segregation laws were not yet cemented, Wells tried to flout the unspoken mandate to segregate so that she could read her newspaper in the much nicer ladies' car in peace. Instead, the conductor and two other passengers tried to drag her to her place in the colored car. She chose to get off the train instead. This long history of black women enduring violent harassment while they are on their way somewhere, anywhere, makes Corrin Gaines' demands to be recognized and respected as a free traveler far less preposterous. I'm also struck by the intimacy of these encounters, the moment when, as Bland and Wells experienced, suddenly a white man is putting his hands on you, yanking you violently away from your intended journey. I wonder about what Ida Wells might have been reading, about what Sandy Bland and Corrin Gaines might have been bumping on the radio, about what thoughts might have streamed through their consciousness as they were on their way somewhere, anywhere. At 21, Wells had had her fair share of young men jockeying for her affections. I wonder if her thoughts moved somewhere between her love life, her love of pretty dresses, and the injustices she was undoubtedly reading about in the paper. The tragic consequences of these traffic and train encounters make clear that intersectionality has intimate consequences. What does it look like for black women to move freely through space when we are always confronting the precariousness of life at the intersection of race and gender, of class and mental health, of love and dreams? Erykah Badu once famously cautioned black women about the cost of carrying around too much baggage. Bag lady, you gonna miss your bus. You can't hurry up because you got too much stuff. Badu then coolly advises, pack light. But of course, that is not entirely our choice. Black women did not agree to or apply for the job of baggage handlers for the nation. With histories as forced laborers and forced breeders, so much of our employment history in this country has simply not been up to us. Our lives are strewn about with structurally deposited baggage. If we assume the radical position that it isn't ours to carry, we're called lazy, degenerate, angry, irresponsible. The nation waves its fingers at us in accusation, demanding that we take the weight. And often we accede to these demands, taking the weight against our will, but taking it nonetheless. Black women take it upon ourselves to challenge stereotypes, to raise respectable children, to build homes, communities, and churches, despite our chronic condition of underemployment. We are masters of wresting sustenance from insufficiency. We combat structurally induced trauma, much as Erykah Badu demanded of both herself and us, by taking responsibility for the weight we carry. I don't even have to go all the way back to Ida B. Wells in the 1880s to be appalled by the amount of social and structural baggage foisted upon the backs of black women. The 1980s was hell on the social image of black women, who were vilified and demonized as money-grubbing, welfare queens, and drug-abusing crack fiends birthing crack babies that the system couldn't handle. Oprah Winfrey as Miss Sophia in Steven Spielberg's 1985 screen adaptation of Alice Walker's The Color Purple uttered one of the most memorable and damning lines about the terrible burdens that America and black men had heaped upon black women. All my life I had to fight, she told Celie after her husband Harpo tried to beat her in an assertion of male dominance. There's a reason why black women my age can recite lines from The Color Purple at will. The film is iconic because it dared, following Alice Walker's lead, to suggest to America that black women were the heroes and not the villains of the American national story. It dared to suggest to a watching world that the baggage we carry is not of our own stitching. And while we black girls always recite these lines to each other in a humorous context, it is mostly humorous because just underneath the surface, the truth of what we say in jest leaps at us with the clarity of an Alvin Ailey performance. If you hear one sister saying to another, "Don't do it, Miss Seeley," you better move out the way because somebody is liable to get cut. Black women power brokers of the 1990s undertook a full-scale rescue mission to resuscitate the culturally devastated image of black womanhood handed to us in the 1980s. In the 1990s, during my tween and adolescent years, I watched women my mother's age explode the black women's chick lit and self-help industries. Books by Yonla Van Zandt and Susan L. Taylor were a staple in my household. Together with books by and about Oprah, Maya Angelou, Terry McMillan, the telltale Pink Women's Devotional Bible with which every black girl of a certain age is familiar, and copies of Essence and Ebony magazines, I watched my mama fashion a clearly black woman and girl-centered household for the two of us. These books and magazines acted as therapy for my working-class single mom who couldn't afford to sit on someone's sofa once a week to discuss her problems. She had a daughter to feed and bills to pay. This bookshelf and coffee table therapy gave birth to two unspoken mantras that shaped our life together. Take care of business, and daughter, heal thyself. My mother used the explosion of a body of literature that spoke to black women's interior lives to get hers together. After the abuse she suffered during my childhood, my mother, tired of being used and abused, began the process of healing herself in my tween and teen years. Years later, she would tell me, "I wanted better for you. And if I wanted better for you, then I had to want better for myself." I watched my mom read Ayanla's Yesterday I Cried and In the Meantime, and I watched as she intently listened when a rare day off permitted her to watch Ayanla on The Oprah Winfrey Show. I was a keen observer of my mother, and I knew she connected to this material, even though I did not always understand why. I liked to read Essence and Ebony, but didn't much care for the rest of it. I saw my mother's admiration for Susan Taylor's monthly In the Spirit column. I read it and thought it sounded good, but too heavy and fluffy for my black girl taste. My mother was a woman, as Alice Walker once said of her character Meridian, in the process of changing her mind. I watched my mother change her mind about her worth and value and then reflect that shift in her romantic choices. She freed herself from a cycle of abuse and in doing so saved her own life. I believe wholeheartedly in the internal spiritual work that black women must do to save our own lives, but I also wonder whether our spiritual work is a match for the structural systems that would crush us alive. Audre Lorde famously said, "If I didn't define myself for myself, I would be crunched into other people's fantasies for me and eaten alive." But what do we do with this push for self-definition and self-recognition in a system that would crush us anyway? It crushed Sandra Bland. It crushed Corrin Gaines. It has crushed untold numbers of trans black women who have been killed simply for having the audacity to live their truth. My own mother modeled the importance of taking care of one's spirit as a means of saving oneself. This was the model of black womanhood that shaped my coming of age, and it still shapes how I move through the world as a grown woman. In the Oprah Ayanla Susan era, my mother would always say to me, when I came home crying about being bullied by mean girls at school, "The only behavior you can change is your own. What behavior can you change so you can avoid this kind of attention?" Even if in the end the behavior I changed was my own mindset, such that the taunts didn't bother me as much, the point was that my mother believed in my moving through the world with a spirit of self-possession. She raised me to be a black girl who believes, sometimes stridently, in her own mind and her own counsel. Akin to that, I believe that each of us is responsible for doing our own emotional work. We can't hope to have healthy relationships of any type if we are unwilling to own our shit. I am struck by the manner in which my mother's ability to show up and heal her own life was made possible in the particular world of the 1990s, a brief moment where black women were allowed to see themselves in their full set of possibilities. The last decade of the 20th century found the nation discovering for the first time what black business owners and corporations had long known, that black women were a target demographic for cosmetics, self-help literature, and chick lit. In 1991, Maybelline launched its Shades of You campaign, becoming the first mainstream cosmetics line to explicitly focus on women of color. Consumer culture scholar and professor Robert Weems has marked this as a watershed event, which led to a proliferation of more than a dozen black women-focused cosmetic lines in a two-year period. Today, I have my pick of cosmetic products that can match and complement my dark brown skin tone, but in my adolescent years, such products were just coming into existence. Weems suggests that so much of black people's experience of citizenship has been tied to consumerism, So when black women became a mainstream target demographic in the 1990s, they experienced new levels of cultural visibility that expanded to other arenas like books and movies. Terry McMillan reached blockbuster success with her 1992 novel, Waiting to Exhale. My mother and I then hustled to the public library on a Saturday morning to pick up her earlier novels, Mama and Disappearing Acts. Or rather, she picked up Terry McMillan novels and I checked out Mildred Taylor books like Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, and Let the Circle Be Unbroken. Oprah officially reigned as the queen of daytime television, providing a platform for Iyanla Van Zandt to dig into the inner lives of struggling black women and call forth a healing. And Susan Taylor's oversight of Essence magazine, with both her In the Spirit column and her mind-body-spirit approach to presenting black women's issues, created a felicitous set of social conditions for black women to come to voice in ways that were more personal than political. Suddenly, black women professionals were talking about the personal stakes of being black women in a world that didn't love us. Oprah and Iyanla, for instance, talked little about racism, sexism, and poverty, but they spoke a lot about the terrible choices we make when we have low self-esteem and don't love ourselves. I wonder if Sandra Bland watched episodes of Iyanla Fix My Life as she struggled to overcome her depression. Now that I'm grown, I regularly pick up Oh, the Oprah magazine, looking for tips to fix my own life. As a 20-something, I ran across a column on narcissism in Oh magazine, and that column named for me the emotional abuse I endured for so many years from an old boyfriend. Reading those words helped me to stop hoping that he would ever change, because narcissists never do. Those words gave me the language to free myself from that relationship, to know that I deserved better. I struggle then with how to simultaneously hold the competing truths that shape black women's public and private lives. On the one hand, I have made many a bad decision, tolerating bad friends and even worse dudes because I didn't love myself as well as I should have. Therefore, I merely accepted what others offered, even when it was so much less than what I am worth. That is the truth. And my process of learning that truth was deeply personal and has been deeply transformative. On the other hand, individual transformation is neither a substitute for nor a harbinger of structural transformation. Holding oneself in perpetually low esteem is a structurally induced condition. Patriarchy propagates a whole series of narratives about black women that are designed to make us hate ourselves. Melissa Harris Perry argues that black women carry a great amount of shame because of our inability to fully inhabit the American dream. In 1965, when Daniel Patrick Moynihan argued that black communities were caught in a tangle of pathology because our communities had a disproportionate number of female-led households, his conclusions had both affective and social dimensions. His 1965 report, The Negro Family, The Case for National Action, offered social and political recommendations focused on ways to help black men become breadwinners again so they could assume their rightful place at the head of black families. But the affective goal of his infamous Moynihan report was to shame black women for the very mundane magic involved in our making a way out of no way. That shame persists well into the 21st century, when more than 70% of black households are female-led. Black women have proportionally higher rates of abortion than any other group. There is no shame in having an abortion. I consider the right to choose the conditions under which one becomes a parent to be one of the most important social values. But I also believe that decades of discourse about poor black women and unwed black mothers being welfare queens who unfairly take more from the system than they put in has shamed many black women into not bearing children that they otherwise might consider having. The idea that only middle-class, straight, married women deserve to start families is both racist and patriarchal. The fact that our society honestly believes that poor women don't have the right to start families because they may require public assistance obscures the variety of ways that middle-class families do receive public assistance. White families have been the primary beneficiaries of both public and corporate welfare in the form of redlining policies that drove down property values in black neighborhoods, making those neighborhoods undesirable for businesses, families, and schools. They have been beneficiaries of favorable bank loan terms to help them purchase safe, affordable, quality housing. They are the beneficiaries of marital and housing tax breaks, and the disproportionate beneficiaries of the dwindling number of quality public schools that we have left. Public discourse on the right paints a picture of brazen black and brown teenagers and unmarried mothers having baby after baby that they can't support to game the system. In fact, the discourse about Corrine Gaines after she was killed was that she was a bad black mother who used her son as a human shield against the cops. But she told her 5-year-old to document what was happening to her, teaching him how to train her smartphone's video camera on her as she talked. Less outrage was reserved for the police who decided that shooting her son, who thankfully survived, was a reasonable price to pay for apprehending his mother, who had committed the crime of failing to pay a traffic ticket. When I talk to Black women in my community, many of them feel shame and guilt about not being respectable Black women in traditional two-parent homes. In middle school, there were only two Black girls in my school's gifted and talented program, my friend Holly and me. We took to each other quickly because Black girls find each other as a means to survive. We were both working-class girls raised by single moms. I insisted on being a good girl, while Holly was definitely a rebel. By her junior and my senior year of high school, Holly was pregnant. Neither of us were strangers to teen pregnancy in our community. Black girls in my community had been getting pregnant since I was in the sixth grade. So when Holly got pregnant, I was concerned and a little sad, but not surprised. She fit the cautionary tale that I was steadfastly trying to avoid because I am the daughter of a teen mom. After many years, we lost contact and reconnected via Facebook. By then, she had had five children and was on her way to baby number six. One day, we inboxed just to catch up, and she told me of the multiple degrees in nursing she had secured and how proud she was of her family. I was proud of her and also feeling just a bit lonely. Yes, Holly's path to family was risky, but she had made it, and I had towed the line and followed the rules a little too well, perhaps. Now, I find myself in my 30s with few prospects of having children in a traditional two-parent family. In fact, my late 30s are beset with the heaviness of receding childbearing options. Still, Holly said to me in the inbox, I'm trying. I don't want to be another statistic. The irony is that I traded being one kind of Black woman statistic for another. I'm now among the scores of professional Black women who are unmarried. This, too, is seen as a failure, as just more evidence of the pervasive social undesirability of Black women. With her six children by multiple fathers and her multiple nursing degrees to boot, Holly challenged every stereotype I might have been invested in believing. And when my doctor at my behest began to walk me through the process and the cost of retrieving and freezing my eggs, I began to wonder if maybe I had done something wrong. Many Black women like me are so obsessed with the idea of not having babies too early that frequently it ends up being too late. No statistic can adequately capture Holly's story. She didn't let respectability politics have the last word. Black women pay the highest cost for investing in respectability politics. First, it breeds distrust between middle-class striving women and poor women of color. We, middle-class women, are taught that those women who were once quote-unquote fast-tailed girls make us all look bad. I never thought about poor women as making me look bad because my community of women was working class. And my mother often reminded me when I became a bit too frivolous with her money, child, we are poor. Like many, many Americans and most Black folks I know, we lived paycheck to paycheck. And given the dubious origins of my birth, my family certainly wouldn't have been invited to Jack and Jill. But I knew very early on that I didn't want to be like the girls in my middle school, saddled with children I couldn't support and doomed to a lifetime of low-wage work with little opportunity for advancement. These are the narratives that working-class good girls buy into in order to make our way out of the hood. The goal to, quote-unquote, not be like them animates our drive and our hustle. But now that I'm grown, I no longer believe that Black women should imbibe shame and blame for all the creative ways that we build families and lives, arrange fulfilling partnerships, and work to maintain safe homes and steady employment. I spent my 20s and most of my 30s waiting on a partner to show up before I would ever consider children because I never wanted to be a single mother. I bought into the idea that making good choices around education and career would entitle me to a broader set of options in every part of my life. But the world doesn't work that way for Black women. In my college, the female-to-male ratio was 3-2. Even assuming that everyone had hooked up in heterosexual pairings, one-third of Black girls were automatically going to be asked out. When I graduated from Howard without having even one boyfriend there, it didn't dawn on me that I was one of the 33%. The optimism of my 20s would not let me consider that these numbers would not improve over the course of my life. My friends and I didn't realize the structural clusterfuck that shaped Black partnering options until we were already in the thick of things. I'll say more about all that in the chapter titled Love in a Hopeless Place, but suffice it to say that we thought, as all young people do, that we had endless time, that our chosen booze would arrive, and that our advanced degrees would bring us into a world of men with advanced degrees and earning potential too. It hasn't worked out that way for a great many of us. In my 30s, I became an unwilling member of the Sisterhood of Fibroid Havers. Black women disproportionately struggle with fibroid tumors, and the medical science continues to offer little explanation. After my fibroid surgery, a successful outpatient procedure that I thought would buy me a little more time, my doctor, a lovely Black woman gynecologist, told me, "More than likely, your fibroids will return. You have a uterus that makes fibroids." Perhaps the saddest part of being reminded of the dreaded biological clock was having to tell my mother that since I had no partner in sight, I might not be able to give her grandchildren. For the first time, I began to wonder whether I should have been less regimented and more reckless in my 20s, when I was younger and had eggs to spare. Black women deserve more options than these extremes. That the same choices we make to not ruin our lives as young people become the choices that make us miserable 20 years later. Part of what friendship has meant in my 30s is supporting my homegirls in their 30s and 40s who have limited partnering options and even fewer options for starting families. The intimate consequences of all these good-ass choices we have made are relentlessly brutal. Yes, folks are quick to say, adopt, freeze your eggs, try in vitro. But with what money? Black women in prime child-rearing age have negligible net wealth. Many of these single women, as first-generation middle class with loads of education,